Hi, this is Women Who Travel, a podcast from Condé Nast Traveler. I'm Lale Arikoglu, and with me, as always, is my co-host Meredith Carey.
Hi.
If there's one thing keeping us connected to our travels right now, it's the souvenirs filling our apartments. They remind us of the places we've been and help inspire us to start dreaming of our next big trip, whenever that might be. But scouring vintage stores and markets for the perfect souvenir is an art form, especially if you want to find something that captures a meaningful sense of place or history. Which is why this week we're chatting to Kiana Stewart and Jana Handy to find out how they curate Black Market Vintage, a Brooklyn-based store that maps the Black diaspora through vintage wares and collectibles. Hi, Kiana and Jana.
Hi.
How are you?
You know, surviving, waiting for my AC to come. Very hot in this room. But very excited to be talking to you guys. To kick it off, can you tell us how Black Market Vintage began and when you evolved from shoppers to collectors and business owners?
So we were officially founded in 2014. Jana and I met a few years prior to that. And I was dragged to thrift stores, flea markets, estate sales, picking things up on the side of the road by my mom, who loved all of that. And it was just kind of our shared hobby. She really brought me into what it was that she was interested in. And so when I met Jana, what was a hobby of mine became really like a hobby of ours. And the way she tells the story is she wanted to date me. And so she was like, well, I guess I got to go along to all these places.
You got to spend time, invest time.
So we were investing time in flea markets, estate sales, all of those places that were dedicated to antiquity, but we weren't necessarily seeing ourselves represented on the walls, in the literature aisles, in the record bins, in the art, the folks who were behind the counters providing context about the items in the shop. And so we felt like there's a void. There's a space that was missing and that we thought we could potentially fill. And it was, again, a hobby at first. We were finding things for our home collection and just things that we thought were really cool. And then friends were really affirming and saying, you know, y'all have a really good eye. Can you keep an eye out for this for me? I'm looking for this particular thing from, you know, the 60s. And so what was a hobby then evolved to like a service we were kind of offering to our friends in our innermost circle. And then we just had the gall and audacity to go full out and to create the business that both of us really needed ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. And I would say that Kiana really changed my perspective on vintage. And so before I met her, it was like all doilies and old white dudes in oil paintings. And it just I didn't see it as something that would really interest me or there was an entry point for me. And once I met Kiana and actually went to her apartment, she's also a dynamic interior decorator. And so just seeing her space and the ways that she used vintage in her space to talk about her Black, her female, her you know, fill in the blank identity, I thought was really, really cool. And so, like, you know, Kiana said, as we were traversing these spaces and seeing that there was a lack of representation of what we look like, we really were just like, why don't we create that thing we wish we had? And so that's how it started. We started off at flea markets, Brooklyn Flea, Artisan Fleas. And so it was just a weekend thing. We both had full-time jobs. We were administrators and professors at Rutgers University. And so we really were just doing it on the side. And once we realized that there was, like Kiana said, the affirmations that this was really something that folks could connect to, that's when it kind of started to scale for sure. Mm-hmm. And it became a business.
Mm-hmm. So you're dating, you're spending the weekends scouring like markets and thrift stores and all that stuff. Jana, when did you realize that you were starting to develop an eye? When did you start to realize that like this was kind of your thing too?
That's a great question. It was actually, so we started dating right before Kiana took some students to Ghana for a work, was it a, not study abroad, but.
It was kind of a study abroad fellowship program for 2 months. Yeah. And so this was right after I finished my master's in women's studies. So yeah, we started dating right before then. Mm-hmm. I left the country for 2.5 months. Yeah. And what happened?
And I was still kind of like missing her, but also frequenting the places that we would go together and then finding new places. And, you know, by the time she came back, I had, you know, this corner of a desk that had all these finds that I'd kind of picked up. And I was just It's like, this looks like a thing happening here. And this looks like it's cohesive. It's telling a story, but also it's something that's fun that I can do without her, but also have her in mind while I am doing it. And so I think that's really where it developed, where it's kind of like she gave me the tools and told me kind of where to go. And then she left me. And then I kind of spent some time honing in my own skills.
What are some of those tools that she left you with? Because I'm curious, like, what advice you would give to somebody else who might be starting off.
I think that lesson that I learned from you initially, or learned from Kiana initially, was that, you know, you can find pieces that speak to you. You just have to dig. And so it's really like, you know, I've come from a very big military family. And so I would started to pick up different, you know, steamer trunks and different military trunks or military bags or, you know, military jackets. Yeah, I love the Letterman aesthetic. And so once I realized where to go, so thrift stores or a flea market, that also, you know, she was the plug. She helped me find out where to go. And then I kind of just is spending the time. And I think that, you know, I joke about the investment in, you know, spending time together, but it really is the time because the kind of work that we do is so time consuming.
Mm-hmm. Kiana, did you come back from those 2.5 months and be like, she figured it out?
Kind of, but you know what? We were FaceTiming so regularly that it would just be like show and tell time. And I would be talking about my days and the work I was doing. And then she would be showing me, you know, the work she was doing, but then also these really great things that she was finding. So I had seen a bunch of pieces, but just the pride. That's the shift that I saw. Like, just this really tremendous sense of pride around, like, I was able to curate this on my own. Mm-hmm. I didn't just, like, come upon all of these things together. This took me 2.5 months to amass. Mm-hmm. Most places are hit or miss. You know, you don't really know. Now we've been able to cultivate the kind of community and network where we know we're sourcing a particular thing or someone has something. But, you know, when you're just starting out, it's hit or miss. You're going into spaces, you don't know what you're going to find. And she had a really, really tremendous sense of pride around what she found. And it made me feel really good and made her feel good too.
Yeah, for sure.
When you talk about creating like a community through the work and the collecting that you're doing, what did that community look like in the early days when you were at like a couple of Brooklyn flea markets and were just starting out?
So in the early days, I mean, it looks similar to what it looks like now, just very, very, you know, like scaled back, scaled down. We were making and establishing a lot of the relationships at the initial point. So we're meeting folks, cultivating relationships, spending weekend after weekend. If they run out of bags, we're there to help them with bags. If they don't have change, we want to help you with change. Can you watch our stuff? Because we need to grab a bite or we need to do X, Y, Z. And so there's this reciprocal relationship between the other folks who were doing similar kinds of work. We were also buying from people regularly. I mean, we'd get to a market around 6 o'clock in the morning to set up and load in and prepare. And we're also seeing what other people are loading in. So we're buying from vendors before they even, you know, set up and open to the public. So I would say that network looked like a mixed community, people with different identities, but a mixed community of folks who were collecting, many folks who were collecting about like the time that we've been alive, like folks who are really experienced and have been doing that work for a long time. Mm-hmm. So it was nice. It felt like we were the youngest people.
Yeah.
In a lot of those spaces. Now that network is much larger, much more robust. There are a lot more people of color in that network than there were then, just because of the nature of the spaces that we were in. And folks now, they know us. They know the kinds of things that we're looking for. And so I think those are the main differences.
For sure. And I think being that we were at flea markets and we were doing that weekend vendor setup life, you know, like you said, a lot of older folks, a lot more men. I think that's also interesting. But also I think there's a bit about the amount, not the amount of knowledge, but maybe the amount of appreciation for Black ephemera and Black memorabilia. Because I'm thinking of like 5 to 7 different vendors who we've met who like at Brooklyn Flea, who are like, I didn't even know this stuff would sell. I didn't even know people were interested in collecting Black memorabilia. And so some of our lasting connections who, like, you know, 5 people I can think of right now who are just like, oh, I have basements or, you know, storage lockers full of this, but I just never knew anybody wanted to buy it.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, in an interview with Traveler last year, Jana, you said one thing this work reinforces is just how much systems influence something as small as your belongings. When did you guys realize that something like vintage shopping could be also a means of retracing Black history and showcasing that there is such a large audience of Black people and people of color who are looking for themselves in this experience?
I think a bit of it from the very beginning. We both are educators by trade. You know, we both, you know, have master's degrees and dedicated ourselves to, you know, the experiences of marginalized people. And so that piece, I think, is imbued in all the work that we've done. Mm-hmm. But namely with Black Market, I just think that's our driving principle, education. Mm-hmm. And so burying the medicine, you know, into something cool and trendy, you know, the thing that I appreciate that some folks, sometimes I'm on Instagram and I'm like, who wrote this story caption underneath this picture? There's no way I'm reading this 8-paragraph caption. But then there are folks who will say something, who'll, you know, Keanu would put a caption up on Instagram and people are, it's 8 paragraphs. And people are like, oh my God, I had no idea. This was the most informational thing I've ever seen. I'm just like, so people are, okay, all right. And it's just affirming. Reading. They're reading. At the very least, they're reading. But I think it's affirming because a lot of folks find a different entry point into our work because of the educational, because of the connection that they're able to make with some of the subject matter.
Mm-hmm. I think I also noticed it really early on. Again, this is a business that both of us needed. And so in a lot of ways, I was and still am curating for myself. Mm. You know, we're doing it definitely for a community that's much larger. But I think at the crux of this is like this comes out of a space of necessity and direct connection to these kinds of histories. And so, you know, when we were at Brooklyn Flea and we were at Artists and Fleas and maybe we would see, you know, a few Black folks come by in a day and experience what we had curated, it was so affirming. Mm-hmm. You know, folks have stepped into spaces that we've curated and the tears are flowing. Mm-hmm. They are talking about how they feel their grandmother in that space, mm-hmm. or how that space reminds them of, you know, their auntie's home or their parents' home or mm-hmm. someone who had passed. And so it's quite powerful. And I think folks who saw us and really understood the meaning of the work really, you know, went out of their way to let us know early on, like, this is needed. I didn't even know I needed it, but mm-hmm. I need it. Mm-hmm.
As you were starting to grow your collection and continue to grow it now, what are some of the sort of most compelling objects that you've come across during, you know, the past few years? And maybe even more specifically, what are the most like compelling stories, if you've managed to hear them, attached to those objects?
This is always a hard one for us because we have so much. We have so much.
So many objects.
And so this, you know, anecdote I tell folks, it speaks to a bit about what Keanu was saying about the time that we've invested in this work. We've been able to cultivate a network. And so I go to flea markets 3 to 4 times a week, but you know, at 5:30 in the morning, there's a dedicated base of collectors and vendors who are there. And I'm at the market and this older white woman comes up to me and she's like, you buy Black stuff, right? And I was like, I really don't know where this is going. I don't know what her angle is. And she was like, come to my car. And I was like, I'm still not sure, but you know what? I'm going. So I went to her car and she pulls out these 2 singed, you know, large format, maybe something bigger than like 28 inches, but large format photos. And they're original photos of Muhammad Ali and his first wife. And around the edges of them, they're all singed and they're not in great shape. And she explained that the original photographer, there was a fire at his studio. And so there are only a couple of things that could have, that were saved in that, or that, you know, survived the fire. Mm-hmm. And those 2 pictures were 2 of them. Mm-hmm. And so I was just like, I'm a huge fan of Muhammad Ali and I have a lot of collectibles of his. And so I just, my mind was blown. It's just like, you never know what you're going to miss out on. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is the piece of it. I tell Keanu all the time, I have FOMO, fear of missing out on vintage, because if I don't go to a market, I'm like, I missed it all. Missed the, you know, the rarest of the rare item. I missed it. But I think an example like that, where, you know, we have these 2 photos, they are not perfect. And, you know, by any standard, if we were to send them to, you know, a mainstream, and I'm using air quotes, you know, mainstream auction house, they may say that it's not really worth much because of its condition. But just because of the story, because of who he is, and also the fact that these photographs were like literally survived.
Literally.
I just like, they're priceless to us. So they're up in our home. And I think that's for me, or for both of us, probably one of the most compelling pieces.
Yeah, I agree. There's a pin that I bought for Jana. It's got to be like a 3-inch diameter pin, maybe 3.5 inches diameter, really big pin. And it has a logo on it, and it's from an organization that her dad helped to found in the 70s in New York City, called the Black Vets for Social Justice. Organization is still functioning today. They're still in New York City. And it was really cool to hear about this deeply personal connection to her, and then find, you know, some kind of memorabilia, some kind of ephemera from that organization that is still doing work to serve Black vets in their respective communities. So I love that I was able to find that for her, and again, make that personal connection. Mm-hmm. It's something sentimental that I know she treasures, that I treasure as well. It's just, it's literally home. It's not close to home. It actually is home. Mm-hmm.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I feel like so much of what you guys have talked about as the thing that really draws you in is that personal connection. And I think when people are shopping, they don't know where to start. And it's clear to me for you guys that your families and your relationship with each other is like a big driver in what you look for. What advice do you have for people who are just starting out, who don't even know like what they want?
The thing is, a lot of the times, like this, it's work now, but it's definitely still a hobby and still fun. But there were so many times early on where I wasn't looking for anything in particular. I just wanted to be in the kind of space, because for me, that space was about exploration. It was about an exchange. It was about the serendipity of it, like me just kind of coming upon these things finding me. And so it was really just about the experience. And I really, really love those kinds of spaces. They're not for everybody. I mean, I go and I know I need to have my things to clean my hands. I need to have an asthma pump because the dust gets to me. I just got to do what I got to do to be in that kind of space. Mm-hmm. But for folks who don't know where to start, or don't even know what they're looking for, I would say there might already be a connection to vintage or antiques already there that they're not even aware of. Many of us have family who are still living or who have passed on. We've got their belongings. So I would think about the ways that those belongings are already functioning for your family, in your home, for your respective community, whether it's photo albums. Just there might be things around you that you are currently using that you can kind of interrogate to think about what your relationship is to vintage and antiques. So that's one place to start. But also just think about what is it that where do you need decor? Like, what are the practical things that you might be able to go to these spaces? Right. Think about function. Did you just move? And maybe instead of going to Home Goods, or instead of, you know, taking to Wayfair or Amazon, like the big box spaces, how can you think a little bit more about sustainability? You might just need furniture and some furnishings in your space, or you don't want to invest a lot and you just want to go to a thrift store and find something that's used because you don't anticipate using it for a long time. I think function is really important for folks.
Yeah. And I think certain things, even if you're not looking for it, it'll speak to you. I think that's also why they say don't go to the grocery store hungry, because then everything speaks to you. But if you're at a thrift store, just go. Even if I'm like looking for a jacket, I go to every single aisle because I just don't know what I'm going to see. Everything is always changing. So it's just, you know, maybe something really would speak to me that I just didn't, you know, anticipate. And I would also say be creative. So one thing that I try to do that you know, going to a thrift store, if I like a pattern, you know, I'm not really a frilly kind of dress skirt kind of gal, but, you know, if I see a pattern that speaks to me, I may use that to reupholster an ottoman or a chair. Or so just thinking outside of the box and trying to see beyond what's in front of you and maybe get a little creative. One thing that Kiana and I used to do early on were thrift store challenges. And so we would go into the thrift store and say, the person who finds the coolest thing for under $2.79, you know.
It was never that low.
Right, you know, it was like $5. It was like the $5 or $10 challenge.
Yeah.
But, you know, whoever won got to pick dinner or whatever the case. And so, you know, challenge yourself just to have a little fun with it because it is a great place to explore.
And it's interesting because a lot of those places, I think they get a bad rap for just being, you know, sterile or it's just old or it's dingy or it's whatever. Mm-hmm. But I also see them as just havens, as these repositories. I see them as really exciting. And I think if you spent a little bit of time there with some preparation ahead of time, particularly now, given COVID-19, I think they could be a really interesting space to just explore.
Bringing up COVID-19, the like perpetual elephant in the room, you know, when you're talking about being in these spaces, like it's so tactile, you know, you're like touching things and, you know, you're like feeling the dust and, you know, the aisles are narrow and you're sifting through things. How have you been in the last few months when everywhere has been closed? How have you been sort of scratching your sort of collector's itch and like staying inspired?
Good question.
Yeah, I think the helpful thing is, one thing I realized we didn't mention is that we, in November of last year, 2019, we opened our first brick and mortar location in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. And so, of course, in response to COVID, our shop is not essential, even though we may think it might be. It was closed. And so, we have a lot of inventory. And so there are items, you know, our previous business model, we were just online. Then we opened the shop and we were online and in store. And then we're now back to just online. And so we almost had a little bit of a bottleneck of product because we had to stock up for the shop. You know, we have two storage units in our whole house and, you know, the shop and then the basement in the shop. And so it became fun to see some of these older things that we put away for restocking and realizing like, well, we have a lot. We have a lot of things.
A lot of belongings.
So that really helped us to scratch that itch in that piece. But, you know, a lot of the markets literally just opened last week. And so with a lot of the phase 2 through phase 4 openings, some of these locations have been able to open back up. You know, it's really about, you know, being comfortable in your decision to expose yourself potentially. But also our network really has come in handy for us. Folks will email us pictures. And so a lot of this now is just online. And folks will say, well, I'm cleaning out this. I finally have time to clean out my storage unit, or I finally have time to clean out the basement. Here are pictures of some things we have.
Yeah.
And so that way we're still sourcing. We're still able to sell new items, but also having some fun in some of the things we've had already.
I'm curious how you guys showcase your finds in your own home and how you strike a balance between collecting and hoarding, not hoarding, but like being able to showcase, but hoarding.
I'm going to change the stigma of hoarding.
Okay.
that's an aside.
I was going to say we're walking the line, but we are not walking the line. I will not speak that into existence. We are trying our best to curate, edit. We can't keep it all. We don't need it all. And again, like we call ourselves like best and blackest antique shop. We don't need it all. It's a curated collection, not a collection. So I think there's just always processes of decision making that we have to contend with. We keep quite a bit and we keep things that we don't know if we can necessarily replace. Maybe this is the first one we come across. We don't know if we're going to find another one of that particular thing, or if there are specific things that we want to keep for our inventory for either museum loans or for prop rental, we'll hold on to those pieces as well.
I think it really is in all of this work, you know, we try to seek balance. And I think that that has really been key, because there are things where it's just, wow, that's pretty. I want it on the wall. There's no other function. You know what I mean? And so there's always a compromise. Not everything is going to be, you know, cute storage. It's just going to be something on a wall that you like to look at. Mm-hmm. And so I think striking that balance, Kiana and I have a bit of a different understanding of that.
Oh, where we do?
And I think that's where we try to find balance, where I'm usually like, oh my goodness, there's 12 of those. We need to buy all 12 of them because we never know if we're going to see them again. And Kiana's like, we just need one. So yeah. I think that also is the balance. I think the function piece is pivotal for us, because we, in our home, you know, how are we creative with some of the things that we have that it's not just collecting dust? And so one thing, an example that we call out, you know, a 1940 Chiquita banana crate. Has all the metal hand-forged fasteners and all that. And we put them up on 2 foot, like about 2 foot hairpin legs. And that's where we put all of our shoes when we come into the house. And so like, how can you use something cool, upcycle it a bit, but let it have a function? So then it's not, I have this crate here, but then I also need another space for my shoes. Mm-hmm. Or if there's a really cool radio, you know, we love like vintage radios and TVs, you know, instead of having them just in a corner collecting dust, prop them up on some hairpin legs or prop them up on some other kind of leg and use it as a surface in your space.
And storage underneath.
And storage underneath. And so things like that really help us edit and find that balance. Mm-hmm. But being collectors like capital C, and then being like personal collectors, I think there's a balance, because, you know, there are certain things that we would want our business to own and push forward and continue to have a robust, you know, private collection. But also there are things we want to pass down to our children. And so what are those things even from now that we then want to hold on to? And I think that's a harder conversation to have, because it's like, how do you not buy everything? Mm-hmm. And because of, it might be history. Mm-hmm. So I think it's all about balance and communication. That's key for us, because we, you know, we can have everything and it wouldn't be a good situation.
Mm-hmm. No, it wouldn't.
Thank you.
I know that this started as a hobby, so I can imagine it's hard now to separate work picking and fun picking, because they, I would assume that they kind of intertwine. But when you guys are on personal trips, vacation, taking a break from working on Black Market, what are you shopping for? How does what you do inform what you're picking up when you're far from Brooklyn?
So I don't know the last time I went on a picking trip and we were like picking for home. Mm-hmm. When we're out picking, we are keeping in mind that like we've got our needs and we've got our space that is evolving. Like our home is filled to the brim, but it is also an evolving space. But we also have a shop and shop inventory. And so I think we're keeping both of those things in both hands, which is why we leave with both hands full oftentimes. And I don't know, there are just certain things that if we're drawn to it, we always ask, like, what does your gut say? Mm-hmm. My gut says I really want to keep this thing, and it might be really difficult for me to part with it. And so that's just going to stay in our private collection. Mm-hmm.
And I think, and it's funny, after just talking about balance, there are no clear boundaries sometimes. And so we'll bring it home. Like every single thing we buy because we have some kind of interest in it personally. Like it spoke to us to buy it, to us to think of a customer who might want to buy it from us. And so there is an interest in everything that we bring home. I think the key is when we do our research, that really is what helps separate items, but also our communication. And so do we need this? Do we, you know, right now, I love portraits. So portraits of African-American folks. The earliest portrait I think I have is from the 1800s, maybe 1860s. And so, you know, at one point I was buying them maybe 5 to 10 a week. And Kiana was just kind of like, let's talk, you know, about what's happening. Because at this point we're still living in a 2-bedroom apartment.
Yeah.
And so it's also, you know, what do you have the space and the ability to do? And so it's just like now that's a different conversation, because we are not only sourcing for our shop, our home, our clients, but also our interior clients, prop rental, like Kiana said, you know, museum rentals as well. we're blessed to be able to buy things and say, man, this is awesome. And we have all these different avenues that yeah. we could exhibit them.
Yeah, I agree. Something else that I didn't think about that often is a determining factor is price and cost. And so there's an auction house that we purchase from when they do sales dedicated to African American objects, history, ephemera. And there was recently a sale or an auction, and we went through the auction booklet looking for things that we could potentially resell, but we weren't going with anything in mind. It was like, let's just see what's here, because there's going to be some really, really interesting objects. Mm-hmm. And then I think, depending on auction day and like who's bidding, it really tells us, is this something that we could potentially flip and make something on? You know, are we kind of maxed out at what we paid on the object, mm-hmm. Or on the artifact? And so cost really, really does impact some of those decisions sometimes. I mean, from that auction, like we bid what we bid because we knew we wanted to keep all of those items for our personal collection. Mm-hmm. We may not have done the same if we were thinking we need to sell these things. Exactly. Because we do care about how pricing and value is assessed.
I don't want you to give away your secrets, but what are some of your favorite places to shop or places that you would travel from New York specifically just to shop them?
Mm, good question. One of my favorite places to shop is the Brimfield Flea Market. And we go usually every Brimfield show, and we'll try to go around midweek, yeah. And stay for like 3 days. It's great because it's like a homecoming. You're seeing all of the mm-hmm. folks that you're in communication with throughout the country. And folks are literally coming from all corners of the U.S. to exhibit their items there. So it's a nice coming back to community, shopping, spending a little time out of the city, getting away. Yes, I would say Brimfield.
Mm-hmm. And I would say your local thrift store. And so it might be called something different, Value, Village, Goodwill, Salvation Army, you know, fill in the blank thrift store, hole in the wall thrift store, because you just never know what you're going to find. And just play. I think that is the biggest thing. Find a thrift store. I would say when you're driving by a store or driving by, you know, a garage sale or anything like that, stop. Mm-hmm. You just never know what you're going to find. And you're not wasting that much time if you just, you know, take a little break.
Make sure you have your mask, but
yeah, now, just, okay, that's a good point. Yes.
Mask, just, you know, mask, gloves, have hand sanitizer, stop, see what's there.
What's there. Yeah, explore. I think that's the biggest tip. Explore. When we travel, I think one of the biggest things is like doing the research ahead of time. So where else can we go? And so mm-hmm. even when we're up at a Brimfield, where we're going there for Brimfield, there's acres and acres and thousands of vendors. You know, it's like Kiana said, a week-long event. You know, we're still looking on the way up. Are there collectors that we know that we can make stops? Are they on the way back? Is there somewhere within 2 hours somewhere else we can go? And so there's just a little bit of legwork that you have to do. Mm-hmm. But like I'm good for whenever we're going anywhere. I'm like, best vintage shop in fill in the blank. And that's where I always, as soon as we book the hotel or the mm-hmm. flight, mm-hmm. you know, or the road trip in this case, mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the first things I'm Googling just to see, you know, what's up there.
Like Jenna said, folks ask us all the time, like, how do you find your thrift store? I mean, many of us have access to the internet now. And so I think use your resources to find what is, you know, in your backyard or in the backyard of the place, you know, you're going potentially.
Definitely.
For people to shop Black Market and also follow you both on social media, where can people find you?
Follow us on IG. We're BLKMKT Vintage, VINTAGE. And then you can find us at blackmarketvintage.com. We're looking at opening, like Kiana said, closer to the fall. So just follow us on IG and keep up. And we're up, like I said, our shop is in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. So as soon as we're open, everybody will know.
So. Perfect. I'm at Oh Hey There Mayor.
I'm at Lale Hannah.
Be sure to check out the store and follow these two. They're doing some amazing work and have some really incredible stuff being sold right now online. Be sure to follow Women Who Travel on Instagram and sign up for our newsletters. Links to everything we've mentioned will be in the show notes, and we'll talk to you next week.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.